During the session, we plan to address some of the issues, and the question is, foot and mouth disease, are we really ready? And that's what we're going to have some experts up here talking about. First of all, I want to thank our sponsor for this program today, and that's Pfizer Animal Health. And so without that, this forum would not be possible. Obviously, the issue in front of us is a dire one. We've seen outbreaks internationally that have really been devastating to livestock, beef producers, dairy producers. And the situation is that the outbreak can go from a local problem to a state and national problem very, very quickly. And that's what we're concerned about, is how we contain and control this kind of a disease. What programs and issues are at stake for you as a producer. The economic realities, we've seen that happen in England, and we know that that was totally devastating for those folks. We've documented that. We believe that there are probably some things we can do in our planning and strategy here to make that less economically devastating for our producers, and hopefully we're going to have some of our speakers that will discuss that. The situation in this country is really two issues that we're trying to deal with. We believe that proper planning can minimize the risk to livestock producers, beef producers especially, and at the same time be able to communicate well to our consumers. And that really is a big issue that we need to communicate to consumers, that this is not a food safety issue, it's not a human health risk, and that they and their families are not at risk. The unfortunate thing is, this is the result of a survey that was done by NCBA in the fall of 2005. And what you can see here, that over 70% of consumers believe that they can get ill from foot and mouth disease, and over two-thirds of consumers believe that foot and mouth disease can be in the meat that they consume. So it's a very serious problem we have with communication and consumer information. So that's one of our big challenges that we want to try to deal with. The other thing that I wanted to mention to you was the results of a foot and mouth summit that NCBA held last fall in Washington, D.C., working with about 100 invited guests from producers and all kinds of regulatory regulatory agencies and scientists. This group really tackled some of the tough issues and hopefully came up with some policy recommendations that will help protect producers from having the kind of devastation that we might have without this kind of planning. One of the things that this did was to really create more dialogue and open discussion, and that's really what we hope to do here at the end of this session too, is to get some more dialogue with that. This is part of the summary. You will be getting summaries that they may already be on your table, The Foot and Mouth Summit really focused on four tenets of preparedness, and that is prevention, detection, response, and recovery. And we believe that those are the four issues or the four main areas that we need to focus on, and you're going to hear a lot more about that from our other speakers. Throughout the summit, the participants had the opportunity to hear updates and current scientific information about planning and research from such groups as Department of Homeland Security, USDA, the National Pork Board, the National Milk Producers Federation, Dairy Management Inc., and the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture. At the Foot and Mouth Disease Summit, we had four working groups. Each one of these working groups spent over a day working through some of the issues in their area. With the outbreak communications group, they discussed and established key communication strategies aimed at national and international customers, as well as sectors of the production chain. So that was one of our really key issues there. Stopping disease progression was the other outbreak group. And they really were looking into the research and weighed some of the implications of vaccination, depopulation, quarantines, and stop movement orders. The other two working groups were disease detection, and they worked looked at the detection and testing procedures and processes for FMD, as well as evaluating methods to coordinate activities among state, local, and federal first responders. The fourth group was the role of science in prevention group, and they reviewed existing programs and emerging scientific research for eradicating FMD and containing the outbreak in the United States. And that's really what our main issue is containment. Follow-up of that summit is taking place. There is, as I mentioned, an executive summary that really captures a lot of the thought and the thinking behind that whole program. I think it was an excellent first step, and we hope to continue to have those kind of dialogues with people from the government and from industry and other livestock industries as well. At this time, I think we need to get into our real speakers here, and the first speaker is Dr. Paul Ugstadt. Paul is the area veterinarian in charge for Texas for USDA APHIS. He previously served as an area veterinarian in California, Nevada, Louisiana, and even Nebraska. He received his doctorate in veterinary medicine from Washington State. Please help me welcome Dr. Paul Ugstadt.
Thanks. I think that's the first time I've ever been introduced as a real speaker.
As opposed to me.
Well, I want to start out with a slide that shows where foot and mouth disease is in the world today. And it really hasn't changed much over the centuries. North America and Australia historically have been free of the disease. Europe attained freedom more recently, but had an outbreak, as we all remember. Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands all dealt with it back in 2001. The fact that Europe eradicated it certainly shouldn't lead us to any sense of false security, because those countries that are in violet are those countries that have had outbreaks in the last couple of years, and as you can see, they're scattered all over the world. So it's out there. 1929 was the last time the United States dealt with this, and of course mass depopulation historically is the way we deal with this disease. Brazil in 2000 in the southern part of the country had an outbreak, which, I mean, other than the fact that these pictures are in color and the previous ones were in black and white, there's not a whole lot of difference in the methodology. The UK, again, the catastrophic event in 2001. The only substantive difference there is instead of burying the carcasses, they chose to burn them. And from a standpoint of loss of livestock, loss of morale of producers, certainly not a pleasant situation. Some recent events and exercises have dealt with this disease. When I was out in California, we did an exercise in the Tri-County area where there's over 750,000 dairy cows, one of the most concentrated areas of livestock production in the country. There was the summit, which Dr. Henning mentioned, and then Food and Agriculture Sector Coordinating Council had a tabletop at about the same time in October of 2006. And we have one coming up in Amarillo, Texas, where some of the major objectives will be business continuity, decisions around use of vaccine, and involvement of local emergency responders. The October tabletop suggested that there were some disease control options that made common sense but seemed to be contrary to conventional thinking that depopulation is always part of the solution. I hope those pictures that I showed you indicate that maybe we ought to try to think about some other means. Both that tabletop and the AFTOSA concluded that there's no clear point or situation at which vaccine should be used. And And that's understandable when you stop and think about some of the complexities related to the use of vaccine. The U.S. participates with Mexico and Canada in the North American Foot and Mouth Disease Vaccine Bank. This is a decision matrix which was put together by those three countries through a series of exercises that started in 2000. And it is complicated because, first of all, you should ask yourself if you can use it, if you can eradicate the disease by stamping out only, then that's the way you should go. If preemptive slaughter can be used, and that's where you slaughter animals that are in close contact either by movement or by proximity to infected premises, then you use that along with, and then you can either use vaccine or not, depending upon which way you go. And the good news is that the World Animal Health Organization now has two different classifications. You can be classified as free from foot and mouth disease with vaccination, or free from foot and mouth disease without vaccination. Comparison between outbreaks in the United Kingdom and Uruguay, both of those took place in 2001. South America has made extensive use of vaccine over the years. In fact, Uruguay was one of only two countries in South America that the United States did recognize as free from foot and mouth disease. Their outbreak in 2001, they lost that recognition. They chose to use vaccine as opposed to the UK, which chose to eradicate their outbreak by simple stamping out. The land mass is very similar between those two countries. The cattle population is nearly identical. There's more sheep in the UK, but the people in Uruguay typically run their cattle and sheep together, which makes the dynamics a bit different. The number of affected herds was very, very similar. You can see where the difference starts in on the number of animals slaughtered because of being positive for FMB and the number that were slaughtered total. Significant difference. The duration of the outbreak was less in Uruguay, but I think that the Brits were at a disadvantage because there were several weeks that went by before they even detected their outbreak. So it's probably not simply a matter of using vaccine or not that led to the outbreaks being different in length. The total cost of the outbreak, I think the bottom line is that the people in Uruguay were fortunate to get by with a much, much reduced cost of the outbreak. Again, this is just a different slide graphing the timeline comparison. As far as our plan for dealing with highly contagious disease, foot and mouth disease being the most highly contagious that we know about, federal quarantine on interstate commerce, we would use the state's quarantine authority on the premises that are affected to prevent the movement of the disease within the state. We want to incorporate state and local emergency response structures in the response. We have a mandate that any animal health emergency would be managed through the incident command system. USDA has six national incident management teams now that are trained and have had experience in responding to animal health emergencies and would be available to respond. And then we also need your help by helping us guide the policymakers to get where we need to be for business continuity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Uckstadt. Next, we are going to save our questions till the end of the three presenters here. Next, we're going to hear from Mr. Bob Ehart. Bob is the Animal and Health Safeguarding Coordinator for the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture. Bob has been with NASDA since December of 2003. Prior to that, he worked for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and worked in Extension. He works on a variety of issues affecting farmers and ranchers. Please welcome Bob Ehart.
I've been telling the other groups that I work in Washington, D.C., where foot-in-mouth disease is more recognized than foot-and-mouth disease, unfortunately. I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the historical aspects, because I think it really makes a difference for us to understand how and where we're dealing with these issues. Prior to BSE being found in England, so in the 1990s, the history of dealing with emergency programs remains pretty much the same as you go look back. But since that time, since BSE and FMD in England, there was a major push here in the United States to look at whether we were prepared or not prepared, and a lot of emergency management plans for animal health developed at that time. Post 9/11 and post Katrina, we have seen massive changes in the way that we deal with things. It isn't that the science, I mean, we've learned a lot in science area, but it isn't that the science has changed that much, or even in some ways our responsibilities, but the way we go about organizing those things and how we actually will put together teams of people to do things has changed dramatically, particularly since post 9/11. I'm not going to go into the details, but the point of this is to show some of the bureaucracy or some of the detail that is required in order to be prepared to deal with any kind of foreign animal disease. The strategy for Homeland Security, there was a lot of things that have been created. There's all kinds of directives that have been issued. Each of those things is a huge book. And then the initiatives in order to be able to do those things, and then actually the components that deal strictly with food and agriculture are massive. One of the things that has frustrated the states a lot of times is that edicts come down from the feds to do something different. And while it's hard on one level to criticize them because they keep improving, the fact that you have to drop everything and then answer their inquiries and needs has been something that has been a major undertaking for most states to be able to deal with. I want to just show just briefly the relationship between the National Response Plan, which everything that's done on any kind of emergency of any kind now has to happen under the National Response Plan. And from that, who's going to be involved is outlined, and the resource bases as to how those are going to occur. The actual incident will be handled under the National Incident Management System. And you'll notice that this is depicted as it's the incident occurs and it's local, state, and federal authorities and responsibilities that lie from that. It's a little bit different in animal issues than it is on natural disasters, and we'll spend a little time on that a little bit later. A little bit more on the massive bureaucracy that's in place. I'm not going to, again, dwell into the details, but the across the top in the green is a number of statutes that's related. And again, prior to the BSE circumstances, we had state laws and we had one federal law that we dealt with, and now we're dealing with a great deal more. In this instance, in order to get up and running fairly quickly, there's a whole bunch of presidential directives. There are now 10 of them. And infrastructure, agriculture as an infrastructure, is the only one of the infrastructures that's recognized in a presidential directive as a priority. It's recognized rightfully as a priority, but it's not funded as a priority. So while we get the recognition that this is an important area, there's a little more that needs to happen if we're going to be able to be prepared to deal with a lot of these issues. The purple is a whole bunch of plans that are in place, and to make it more complicated, there's at least that many state plans that are involved in this issue as well. I mentioned the fact that there's this disconnect, and if there's ever an opportunity, if you're running into any of the folks that are in Congress, to let them know that the concern about having emergency management, which is an important function, separately funded from agriculture, would be a great benefit to, I think, the state programs. It isn't that we don't understand why that's happened. The power base in Washington on emergency management and homeland security is a different power base than that's most interested in agriculture. And while we really want to keep people that understand and appreciate agriculture involved in that, the power bases argue with one another over who gets more credit for what aspect of things, and as a result, funding for a lot of the issues that are germane to agriculture have been underfunded and do create some level of problems with that. The good news is that every state does have an animal health emergency plan in place. There are some levels of inconsistency post 9/11 and Katrina. There's probably a number of areas where dealing with all hazards instead of animal health that needs to be kind of tidied up a bit. A lot of states have had tabletop exercises. Several of them have had field exercises. These are real important because there are that link between the state and federal and the industry as we look at the ways in which we can properly deal with these kinds of issues, and they certainly will continue into the future. Let me talk a little bit about how I see an issue if FMD is found in the United States actually playing out, because it's a little bit different than the normal National Incidents Management System diagram. FMD is a reportable disease, and as a result of that, if it's found any place in the United States or suspected, it's to be reported to the state and federal agencies, and obviously getting it to either one will inform either one of them. What's significant about that is it automatically puts in place a joint state-federal operation center. So there's going to be some connection between what the local agencies might have as a response, but there'll also be a federal agriculture, animal agriculture layering on top of that. There's also going to, I would think, in all instances I can imagine on FMD, also be a national center established. What this matters for is not so much the bureaucracies itself, but more in how resources are made available. The sooner that we get to state and federal, the more different avenues of where resources may be available comes into play. Because of the fact that FMD more than likely will be considered to be an act of terrorism, even if it doesn't turn out to be, it's almost assuredly that FBI will be involved in dealing with the issue right from the start. It's a significant issue in the past when we've had incidents of concern to the FBI. They're more interested, they have been in the past, more interested in dealing with the criminal investigation, and they want to secure the evidence. That's changed. Their priority has been very clearly made to them that they have the obligation to help keep business moving in this country, and therefore I think it's a very good sign that their role is more going to be in charge of looking at the criminal activities, but also making sure that we keep in place the ability to recover from these things as quickly as possible. I think it's also useful to note that in any of these incidences, the federal authority kicks in and requires that they be actively involved and directly responsible for a lot of the activities. What's valuable in that is that resource base, but the other thing that is of concern is how quickly can the federal government act. Katrina is probably not a good example of what we can expect in all instances, but the realism that for the first week to 10 days, the states should be prepared to deal with an incident is pretty important. So the idea that just because the feds have authority doesn't necessarily mean that the feds are automatically going to be there at the time and everything is going to run hunky-dory. So we got a recognition of the importance of having local people, state people actively involved. So let me just go through a kind of a hopefully how we would like to see an FMD outbreak if it unfortunately occurs work out. It's imperative that it be reported early, so the kind of the awareness of what it is, having veterinarians involved and making sure that those reports are made properly is very good. We sense that oftentimes the hurdles to get a federal quarantine in place take longer than it does at the state level. So the concurrent authority at the state level to get a quarantine in place to make sure that animals aren't moving is a very important part of the whole thing. It fits completely within the model that we were seeing that Paul showed just a little bit ago. Hopefully we'll also see that state-federal joint center put into place, and hopefully we'll also see the deployment of resources as quickly as possible. I actually see the animal agriculture, not just FMD, but in FMD is a classic example of it, but I actually see animal agriculture as rural America's World Trade Center. It's one thing that really requires us to pay attention to these issues. It really requires us to make sure that we understand the gravity of harm that could occur. There's, I think, currently a disconnect in that funding mechanisms between emergency and agricultural agencies, and while that doesn't need to be a major problem at some level, it makes it more difficult. We're really having to work with all kinds of unnecessary hurdles that we're involved in. And when an incident occurs, we're going to see plenty of emergency funds made available. Where this really counts is in the planning and cooperation areas. We're not finding the levels of funding available to make sure that we can be paying attention to all the planning that needs to be done in order to make this a little bit easier on us if it does occur. Another one of those things that I think is an impediment is the lack of an accurate premise registration system in place. No matter how people feel about the other activities that are associated with it, with animal identification and things like that, it's very clear that if we don't know where the premises are, it's going to be more difficult or more resource-intensive at the time to find where the farms are, the animals are, and to deal with an issue like FMD than it would be if we did know where they are. So if we're really looking at an area where we can have a huge benefit, it would be very appropriate to know where the locations are. Now, I don't want to come across flippantly, but I do want to leave you with some of the things that I think are things that would be helpful if we could pay attention to. I have a great deal of confidence in the people that are involved at both the state and federal level to be good leaders if an occasion occurs. I do see some things where we have some holes. Legally, I'm a little worried that we're in the position of feeling like, oh, don't worry, everything's self-correcting. I've actually had Senate staff people tell me that their bosses actually believe that. Policy. We all agree on what needs to be done. When to vaccinate versus depopulate, right? Of course we don't. But we've got a little more work to do in that area. Strategically, we know where all the promises are, don't we? Of course we don't. Organizationally, trust me, everything's been taken care of. I don't think we're there either. Institutionally, do square pegs fit in round holes? That's the closest example to me of a number of activities as well. People have good thoughts, good ideas. We're working in a system that wasn't set up to have this work this way, so we're trying to fit things into things that aren't set up to work that way, and it's a real disconnect in that area. Scientifically, is one arm tied behind our back. We keep talking about the needs to have the surge capacity to do the scientific investigations, the analysis, diagnostics that we need, and yet we're not necessarily at that point as well. And financially, it's in the mail. I think that we need to recognize that some of these things feel a little bit like we're not working in the areas where we would be best benefited. And as I mentioned, I don't want that to sound flippant, but it is a number of areas where we really do need to have some efforts if we're going to succeed. People are good. When the response occurs, I think we'll see a lot of activities that will take place, but it indeed does need a great deal more attention than what we've been able to give it. If it's a small incident and quickly contained, I don't see that as a problem. It's where if FMD begins to spread that all of these things become an issue. And you've seen some of the pictures from the England effort. We want to avoid this if at all possible. Risk communications, what we need to have available to us to know what to say and when to say it to the press so that these things are covered accurately is very important. The other part of it is, as well, is if it happens in one location, actually this is a disease that will actually have a financial impact on all other states as well. So it's something that we need to be ready for, recognize the consequences, and pay particular attention to that. I look forward to your questions when we get to that time.
Thank you very much, Bob. I think it put a lot of things in perspective for many people out here. Next, I would like to introduce our third speaker, and he is Mr. Greg Baxter from Grand Island, Nebraska. And Greg is a feedlot owner and rancher, and he recently participated in a government assessment of bioterrorism vulnerability. And he's going to share some of that experience with you today. Greg.
Yes. Now, regardless of the impressions you might all get by the time I get done with this, I'm not going to ask everybody stands up and gives us a three-march chant, but to a certain degree, that is a little bit of my personal undertaking and goal as a board member of the Nebraska Cattlemen to try to motivate producers to get out there, be more vocal, and be that champion for our industry with those elected officials. The summer of 06, I had an experience with participating with the SPPA program. SPPA is an acronym for Strategic Partnership Program Agroterrorism Initiative. Now, you might ask, why did I, or like I said earlier, for God's sakes, how did I manage to get involved in this? And to answer that, I need to tell you just a little bit about myself and my family. I'm a third-generation cattle feeder. And I say that with pride. My primary interests are in the feeding sector of the industry, but we do have considerable interest in the cow-calf as well as the backgrounding sectors as well. My grandfather founded and operated the facility from 1935 to 1969. At the time he died, my father took over the operation, expanded on the facility itself, and has continued to today, still operating and involved with some facets of the operation, although the last 20 years he's handed most of the daily operations over to me. Both my grandfather and my father were always very involved with the industry associations and their predecessor organizations, both at the state and the national levels. And this is something that has always been instilled in me. I tell you this for the simple reason that I wanted to demonstrate the long-time commitment and sense of duty that my family has always felt existed to serve the industry. It's this sense of duty, hopefully contributing, making positive contributions along the way, to help this industry prosper and thrive, that led me to participating in the SPPA program. When I was first contacted about giving this presentation, I put a considerable amount of thought into what details and specific technical information I could talk to you about regarding health, animal health vulnerability issues. When I saw the agenda and who the other speakers were today, realizing how obviously outgunned I would be intellectually and with specific technical information, first thought I had was, what can I possibly contribute to this forum? And it was through pondering on that question for quite some time that gave me a revelation that I have something that these other speakers cannot possibly speak to, not as academics and health professionals and government agency representatives, but as a producer. Folks, my soles on my shoes are hard and they're leather, and I wear boots, and I'm a cattleman. It's through this perspective that I'll share my experiences in the program. Including myself, there was a total of 16 other on-site participants representing 9 different organizations and various branches of government agencies, DHS, both state and federal level of USDA, FDA, and the FBI. When I thought of these agencies, the first thought that came to my mind was, what in the earth could FBI agents possibly know about cattle? But when we started going around the room and introducing ourselves, I have to tell you, I was very impressed. Impressed with the fact that agencies employ individuals such as this with actual field experience, with several of them being licensed veterinarians. But all were highly respected in their own rights. Now, this is not to imply that they know what are and are not realistic expectations in implementing measures to address emergencies such as this. And at first, there was a little bit of an intimidation factor to deal with from the number of and the background of people and agencies involved with the exercise to the binder of information, including almost 4 pages of acronyms to familiarize ourselves with and a very onerous-looking confidentiality agreement. We conducted an on-site tour where I left no door closed and no stone unturned, but all was still completely at my discretion. The entire time that we are conducting the tour, the visitors remained very considerate, gracious, and respectful of our privacy. The operation and processes that we looked at were then broken into nodes, or very specifically identified individual physical qualities and traits that take in processes that take place. We looked at and discussed each one of the nodes individually as well as collectively, identifying their interrelationships that they have with each other. Example being that individually, an employee, the storage facility for vet products, the vet products themselves, and the administration process of those products all have their own individual traits for integrity, but yet they also have their own individual traits for the risk exposure. And collectively, they possess additional or even possibly a whole new set of vulnerabilities. To do this, we used a method called the Carver plus shock method, which by definition, this is an offensive targeting prioritization tool that has been adapted for the food sector. It allows you to think like an attacker by identifying the most attractive targets for attack. Using this method as a tool allows for each individual industry and operation to assess their vulnerabilities and focus the available resources on addressing them. Carver is actually an acronym. It stands for criticality, accessibility, recuperability, vulnerability, effect, and recognizability, each of those having a very specific description of what that entails. Using the Carver plus shock method helps to realize and identify the variability of the outcome and the end conclusions that are drawn based on what the specific disease is. Now, we did not study FMD in that exercise. We had chosen a different foreign animal disease. Today, we are discussing the threat of FMD. Due to the fact that North America has been FMD-free for several years in itself implies that the introduction would be from an intentional act and probably from over the pond or foreign in nature. However, the Carver method helps to realize that such an act could also be from within or of a domestic origin, such as a disgruntled employee, whether it be of your own employment or that of someone else's, such as a supplier of feed or vet products. Additionally, the process takes into consideration the various challenges that a biological agent or virus may face and be challenged with under normal conditions in order to carry out a successful attack. Examples of these would be an organism's natural lifespan, pH level that it can survive in, temperature, and photosensitivity. The mode of infection, does it have to be direct? Can it be passed from one animal to another? Can it be airborne? All of these issues and challenges can impact an organism's ability to survive long enough to still be viable at the point when the opportunity presents itself to actually expose the animals. As I reflected back on the experience just as I was preparing these comments, it really made me stop and step back and give me pause, considering the current protocol that we employ, but also possible new practices that we can implement to assist in mitigating potential exposures in the future. The experiences that I had while participating in the SPPA program were very enlightening and encouraging. They helped me to understand the complexity of the process that would need to take place in the event of an actual emergency. The need for so many agencies and interests to be adequately represented is crucial, but perhaps even more crucial is the need for the industry affected to participate and have adequate representation in exercises such as this. It is this process of conducting these field case studies which is so very important to our industry, and the ability of the various agencies to proportionately respond to such an event. If there ever was an actual event, conducting the discovery process in the field at the time could possibly take too long to adequately respond on a timely basis in order to limit the negative effects that an emergency such as this could have on the entire industry. Remember the adage that chance favors those who are prepared. These are measures that can be taken to improve the. There are measures that can be taken to improve the facility's security. The standard operating procedures. Do you and your entire staff know the correct protocol in the event that they suspect that there may be a major health-related illness going through the herd? Just as important as, and perhaps almost more than knowing what the proper treatment would be, is identifying very early whether a serious threat exists. The key to this is further education for all people responsible. I'm not suggesting that everyone needs to become an astute professional in foreign animal diseases. However, knowing and identifying a possible issue is only part of the responsibility. Knowing the proper protocol for notification and communication to the proper offices and having the contact numbers available to the individuals responsible is paramount. It's as simple as knowing how to contact your consulting vet or your state veterinarian's office in most cases. From that point, further assessments can be made to determine whether or not a serious situation warrants notifications to further agencies so that a strategy can be implemented and to try to protect the animals and the other herds. One of the biggest risks that we have is the speed with which commerce takes place today. With cattle being purchased from a sale barn, getting on a truck, and traveling 400 miles to a feed yard somewhere in another state happening every single day, the potential for airborne pathogens exposure is very great. In order to limit the exposure to a minimum, it is a must to know the correct protocol and have a plan to prevent the spreading by locating and stopping cattle in transit. The bottom line of what I want for every person in this room to take away from my comments is the important role that you could play in the health of our industry. The emphasis should not be put on what conclusions were drawn or how they were drawn or what the protocols were, but on the importance of we as producers participating and assisting in the development of those conclusions and protocols. If any of you ever had the opportunity to participate in a study such as this, not only would I highly recommend it, but I would hope in your heart you would feel obligated to do so for the health of our industry as a whole. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Greg, for your perspective and your insight from having gone through that experience. At this time, we're open the floor to some questions. We just ask that you step up the microphone, state your name, your home, and ask your question. Yes, sir.
Yes, Wade Zimmerman from Colorado. And I was at the summit in October representing the producer segment somewhat. And I just thought I'd like to add a few comments into your very revealing presentation here. And as I'm speaking strictly as a producer, and on the first hand, the first comment I would like to say is I was amazed at the level of participation, you know, from one end to the other. The spectrum's very broad of the participation, the qualified participants that are trying to come up with a plan in this event, okay? I was also, as I left there, a little bit discouraged that we weren't a little further down the road than where we are today with a very solid plan. You mentioned two of the areas, I think, that kind of everything else falls under, one being containment, and one being communication, and I see those really as the producer segment. As Mr. Baxter just talked about, one thing that I didn't really realize when I was at the summit until at the very end, almost wrapping things up and sitting at a table, I wonder if the panel of experts and the people involved outside of the production segment truly understand the transportation process, and this became very evident sitting around a table. Mr. Baxter gave the example of coming from the sale barns to the feedlots, and that's basically what I got the model to be for containment. And I have to tell you, that is not the only transportation. And when we started drawing specific scenarios outside of that scenario, I think there were some people around that table that thought, how do we deal with that then? I mean, you can contain that model, okay? But when you figure everywhere else that things go away from that model, it becomes ominous very quickly. And then we talked about the indemnity issue as being from the producer segment. If you are going to have containment, okay, immediate containment, there has to be the communication beforehand, well beforehand, right now to the producers of the process of containment. The indemnity issue has to be there. Coming from southeastern Colorado right now to this meeting, I could not go home and communicate a lot of confidence in those producers that the government is in charge here and everything will be taken care of. They're still standing there wondering how this is all going to end up. But all in all, leaving there, I was very impressed with the knowledge that we do have. We just need to seem to pull it together and communicate together. I still have the issue. I wander back and forth. We have the state agencies and we have the federal agencies, and I wonder if maybe at the point in time that if it ever does happen, that we might have a little paralysis going on, wondering who really is in charge there. But that's just a dumb producer out here. Who's in charge of what at that point in time? But great summit. You guys ought to have a lot of confidence in the who's around the table on this issue.
Thank you for your comments. I guess I would just add to that is that, you know, we believe there's still some loose ends, one of those being the indemnity issue, one of them being premise ID, and several other things along with that. Our Animal Health Network is trying to work closer with the U.S. Animal Health Association to try to provide a little input into, you know, some recommendations and policy for that to help that go along. Does anybody have any comments? Any other questions, comments? Must have covered everything very well. I'd certainly like to thank our speakers. I know it's getting late. Yes, sir.
I just had a question. If you don't know much about this disease and you just had cattle, how would you know if they had foot and mouth disease? What do they look like when they have?
Okay.
I mean, you say reporting it fast, but I wouldn't have a clue.
Okay. I'll let Dr. Ugstad handle that.
Typically with foot and mouth disease, and I probably should have included some pictures of clinically ill animals to would have helped, but they have lesions in the mouth and around the muzzle, so you will see typically it's not excess salivation, but their mouth is sore, so they don't want to swallow because that makes it worse. So you'll see the saliva dripping sometimes because it also affects their feet. They'll be sore, so they'll be standing in one spot. They don't move around. So they don't move to food. They don't move to water. They don't want to eat because their mouth's sore. They don't want to drink because their mouth's sore, and even the act of swallowing causes more pain. So they lose condition very rapidly. They're sore. They salivate. You'll see animals with just puddles of foam around their mouth because they're standing in one spot, and that saliva just drips off onto the ground. So those are the classical signs in cattle. Loss of condition in dairy cattle, milk production drops practically to zero very, very quickly because in addition to the feet and the mouth, the udder is frequently affected as well.
Can I respond to that a little too? Just as a reference for everybody, the University State of Iowa has an outstanding website where there's a link on their main page specifically addressing foreign animal diseases. If you go to that page by an index, alphabetically ordered, you can click on the name of the disease and it'll come up with an entire PowerPoint in color presentation about that disease, giving you not only text descriptions but actual photo descriptions of what symptoms are.
Good point. There are several references on the internet to find more information about that too. Well, I think in the interest of time, we're going to cut off the question. I'd like to thank our speakers very much. First of all, they all did a great job.